You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to the Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast, where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Deja Q. I'm Ben from Arizona.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. Go Cornhuskers again today. And Ben, you were recently, I mean very recently, described as the second favorite captain on Upper Pylon 2. I was just curious, how are you handling that, being only the second favorite and not the favorite?
You know, Lou, I noticed that too when that podcast was being recorded. And I have to say this, I am not a captain. I'm a fleet admiral.
You promoted yourself.
No, sir. No, promotions are given as they're deserved. And if you're well aware that I am on the forum, that's where I exist as Captain Proton. But that's just my avatar's name. My rank is Fleet Admiral.
Then why am I still midshipman on the mopping crew?
Well, you gotta talk more, I guess. I guess you gotta interact more with the, you know, the community.
Yeah.
As does everybody else, by the way. I want to put that out there.
Yeah, I suppose so. Are you guys getting this blip on Skype saying that your call is about to be hijacked? Who the hell is this?
Hijacked.
Who's this Chris Johnson? He keeps banging in on my Skype saying that your call will be hijacked in 10 seconds. 9, 8.
He's a scallywag, that's what
7.
He is.
Really? Who is he? 6, 5, 4, 3. I cannot do anything to stop it. 2, 1.
Arrgh, mateys! I've come aboard!
Oh, man. What is this all about?
I was listening in. I heard that you were doing a Q episode, and just wanted to swing in and steal the ship and steer it towards destruction.
Absolute total destruction.
Well, if yes. You're going to take over the ship, do I get a promotion from the mopping crew?
No. No. Mm. Not at all.
Mm, great.
Well, I don't think Chris quite has the authority to promote or demote yet.
Yeah, I don't. I think I'm still a crewman.
You're not, probably.
You're not an important person. Yeah, but I'm way back in the Enterprise era as a midshipman. So, okay. Now, Chris, where are you from?
I'm from Columbia, South Carolina.
Really? Like another Chris? That's amazing. There's another Chris.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's on a Trekmate podcast. He's also from South Carolina. So, do you guys know each other?
I have no clue who that guy is. All I know is South Carolina has a much better conference than the Cornhuskers.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine so. I can imagine. Well, yeah, I know, but Melissa deals with him every week, and she's told me a lot about him, so maybe you'll be better than he is. I don't know.
I think I've heard his name. He's kind of a frustrating guy, a little too positive for my taste. I think I'm going to bring some more negativity than that guy brings, you know?
Yeah. So, Chris, why don't you tell us where you are, you said South Carolina, but tell us about your podcast that I mentioned earlier.
Well, it's technically Melissa's podcast, but I am on Upper Pylon 2 with Melissa every week, where we review Deep Space Nine, which was going to be your next shtick, but I'm not sure what you're going to do. Are you going to do Deep Space Nine still?
Well, we're thinking about it, but you know, your run will be about 2-3 years into it before we get into it, so I think it'd be
right.
A good
Maybe
time.
Maybe we could do some battles, like we could have some back and forth battles when you get there. Anyway, So yeah, we do Upper Pylon 2, and then I also do a book review podcast, which is much lesser fanfare for that one. But we're basically continuing on the Voyager from Delta Quadrant and going through all the relaunch novels for Star Trek Voyager.
What's the name of it?
And that's called Continuing Missions.
Okay.
Actually, it's called Voyager's Continuing Missions. We had to change it because of some technical difficulties with another station not to be named.
Yeah.
Grr, the evil station.
Yeah. Well, hey, Melissa, just keep in mind that even though I may have started this, this is Doc's podcast as well. So there's an equal relationship. Okay, so you only get 25 or maybe 33% there, Chris. But
actually, I'm at like 8. But eight? Yeah, I have a low percentage stock range.
Okay, Doc gets 51 because he's the most talent.
Nice.
So can I make a suggestion about this vying for power amongst the Want to Be Deep Space Nine podcast? Why don't you just do them in reverse order, Lou? Why don't you start at the very end and work your way to the beginning?
I wonder if we would meet each other somewhere at some time.
Yeah, and then we could just fight it out.
Yeah, well, Doc's already named the show our future.
Uh-oh.
Yes, since you're Upper Pylon 2, we're going to be Lower Pylon 2. Because we're always going to be under you.
We're Lower Pylon 3.
Oh, was it 3?
Yeah, Lower Pylon 3.
Yes. We can never be as good as you guys, so we'll be the Lower Pylon.
I'm going to break off and just have a Deep Space Nine podcast with Ben and call it the Docking Ring.
That sounds dirty.
That did. That's a little bit. Change the D.
Hey, it's there. It's on the station, the Docking Ring.
Okay, well, tell us about your co-host there on your show, there, Upper Pylon.
Oh, yeah, we got a great crew of characters. We have Melissa, who is the heart and soul of everything. You know, she's the straight-laced churchwoman from the Midwest who brings her particular flavor to Trek. And then we have Matt Smosky, who's just, a rude, crude, bad dude from New York who... lays out all of our science. He's basically our doctor. Mm-hmm. And then we have Blair, who's our really nice and sweet Canadian, who comes through and gives us the old school Trekkies view.
The medic.
Of it, because he's been Trekkie for a long time. Medic 1849, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we have one recurring guest host, I think, now. And that's Tech, who is just a dour, expressionless... he's like a tropical depression. He just wants to bring down every single good thought we have about Trek.
Okay.
He's our Huckleberry.
Huckleberry. Okay, Ben, what about you? What are you doing now? Anything, or did you just stop podcasting altogether?
I'm on your show.
Well, I meant you don't do your own.
No way. I've had enough of that nonsense.
Really?
Yeah, I only joined the Delta Quadrant because Voyager is like the most crapped on series of all Trek, and it's not deserved in any way, shape, or form. And I always knew that if the best Voyager podcast would fail, probably the original too, then the Voyager would never succeed to get the credit it's due. So I only joined because of that. No other reason.
All right, and refresh my memory. Ben, did you give every episode on Voyager a 5?
No, because I was forced to... Well, let me back up for a second here.
Yeah, you better back up for a second.
There are two people that exist within me. At least there were when it came to the Delta Quadrant. There was who I am, which you hear today, and there was that man which you heard on that show. And they had to be separate individuals. They had to be, one was a caricature and one was just a character. And maybe you can distinguish the difference between the two. I don't know. But I personally think that ratings are really silly because I listen to tons of Star Trek podcasts and I've heard tons of people rate tons of things and all sorts of lists seen all over the internet. And what I realized was, much like James, that nobody has a fine understanding of what the difference between a 4.11326 and a 4.52789. I mean, there's no empirical objective way that people rate. So I was like, well, I'm not going to be one of those people that I don't like to be. So I'm going to find the most objective rating system possible. And that just happened to work out as I just rated the episodes, the number of stars that which I had seen the episode in my lifetime. And being the most ridiculously obsessive person in the world, I have actually counted how many times I've watched every episode. because I've had the DVDs of all the Star Trek since they've come out, and I would scratch underneath the title how many times I've seen them. So if I watch it once, it gets a mark, then a mark, and then a mark for each extra time. And Voyager happened to be one of the least watched series that I'd ever gone through, because basically it's the worst. And so it happened to be that it worked out really well that for the majority of the Voyagers, I'd only watched 2, 3, 4 times, some more than that, that were, you know, outstanding episodes. So that's how I rated it. But outside of that, I think that all episodes are perfect and awesome and should be watched over and over and over again, and that you can never tire of them. So they should all get 5 stars.
Fascinating.
Does that make more sense now?
Yeah, I think that might be the first time I've ever heard you explain that.
No way!
No, he's explained it.
Lots of times.
Really? I've never heard it.
Yeah. This was when I fell in love with Ben, was when he was explaining his not arbitrary rating system.
It's the most arbitrary, exactly, Chris. It's the most arbitrary way to rate an episode, yet it is the most consistent way to rate an episode. It's just, and it was the lucky happenstance.
Fascinating.
But ultimately, you are the Lego movie of Star Trek Raiders.
Wait, what?
You're the Lego movie of Star Trek Raiders. Everything is awesome. Everything is cool when you're part of the team.
Oh, man. Thank you. That's perfect. Yep, indeed.
Okay, then. Cool enough. Let's see where we're at. All right, Ben. In the group chat is going to be the synopsis whenever you're ready.
The synopsis for tonight's episode is Q is seeking asylum on the Enterprise after he has been thrown out of the Continuum and stripped of his powers. This is the 13th episode of Season 3 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date is February 5th, 1990, written by Richard Danu and directed by Les Landau. Guest stars include guest star edit, John Delancey as Q, and special guest star edit, Whoopi Goldberg as Guinan.
Thank you.
Co-stars, Richard Cancino as Dr. Garen, Betty Muramoto as scientist, and I guess that's all.
That will be it.
Okay.
All right, so what do we think
I just want
of
to
this?
Point out.
Go ahead.
Well, I want to point out that Q is stripped of more than just his powers here.
Uh-oh.
He was stripped of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you think about this episode, Chris?
He was ticked about being put in clothes after he was stripped of everything, which makes me wonder, do the Q just roll around naked all the time? Mm. And if so, was the Q in the gray really an honest look at what the Q are? Ben?
Hmm. That's like the worst episode of Star Trek ever. Just want to put that out there first and foremost. The only episode that deserves true mediocrity, right in the middle at 2.5. Because as I was watching that episode of Q in the Gray, I shut it off. I was like, I'm not watching it. I'm not doing this to myself. I'm not going through this nonsense. Q was perfect before he came on Voyager, and I don't need to see any more of this. However, this episode I think is awesome.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I've got a little captain's log here. I do them from time to time. It says, Captain's log. We're like a dot next to this big-ass moon, which has begun to slip out of its orbit of Briel 4. Making matters worse is the planet is now coming into view, making us look like what Mr. Worf calls a globfly. We have an important mission, but for now, I'm in a staring contest with the leader of this planet over the view screen, during the reading of this log. First person to blink has to make the moon return to its normal orbit. Oops, looks like it's up to me. I think that's what the captain's log was. Was that close? Doc? You haven't talked once.
Have I not? Not yet. That's pretty much the captain's log.
I mean,
as far as I remember it,
they did stare at each other over the view screen for a bit.
Actually, I didn't like the guys on the other side of the view screen. You know, the alien scientist people.
Why?
I don't know. I thought in particular the woman was very weak in her delivery.
Mm.
She had weird pauses before she had to like run up to words like seismic and tsunami. And I thought it was a bit of a you have flashcards there that have been shown to you off screen. I've never actually liked her particular performance, and this is probably one of the only times I've tried to call out one of the co-stars. But I didn't think that, as a result, I didn't like them. So I felt that I wasn't really invested in saving millions of them with the moon hurtling towards the planet.
Hmm. Wow.
It felt a little too Asian stereotype to me, their whole performance there.
Really?
And I don't know what it was about the performance that made me think, wow, this is a weird Asian stereotype, but it just struck wrong. It was like, what's the Code of Honor? Is that the episode from the first season where they do the African stereotypes?
Mm.
Or the African American stereotypes, I should say. It struck me wrong too, James. I'm with you on that. It's just a little odd and not quite. I just couldn't get comfortable with it. I'm glad they weren't around long, is what I'm saying.
No, and that's true. They're completely immaterial to the show. You know, they happen to be a face of, you know. You check in on this little ticking time bomb every now and again, and I don't even think that's necessary. But you know, away from them, you know, other guest stars on the show are great.
Oh wow! You know, I'm looking at her now. I did not detect an Asian thing until right this second. He's not, but yes, she obviously is played by an Asian character or actor.
Specifically, not just Asian, but specifically Japanese. That's what I've always gotten from this. I want to put out her delivery. I want to like pass it off as the makeup because, you know, when you look at them, they have such a small, tiny orifice for a mouth. But in the end, I can't pass it off as anything other than a huge mistake of direction.
Hmm. And she gets to describe the tsunami.
Yeah.
Okay.
None of that matters, of course.
No, not really.
Nope. Because it's all window dressing for the big arrival of
Q. But before he gets there, this is what we have to do today. The Enterprise is going to have to try to coax the moon back into its normal orbit, which I kind of thought it'd be like, you know, grabbing a hold of a nail on the outside of a house and dragging it to another lot, the whole house, just by grabbing the one nail sticking out of the wall.
Yeah, I could see that. That's actually a really good metaphor for it, I think.
Analogy.
I was actually hoping Dr. Roberts would lead us down the absurdity of the Enterprise's power availability to move such a massive body. I can only imagine that.
Would you like him?
Yes, I would like him to school us.
There you go. That's what you got to put in. Now I'll know what to do. Okay, Doc.
Hang on. So what exactly do we want here? Because I don't think I'm that upset with this episode in terms of, there's the setup seems to be that there's a deteriorating orbit for some reason, and, you know, the moon is getting closer and closer and closer. They kind of are trying to realign it, and they're trying to, you know, do it by tractor beam. I suppose it depends on how big the moon is, right, as to how easy that's going to be. I actually think that it's perfectly reasonable this week.
Okay, let me ask you this, Doc, see if I sound right.
Go ahead.
My analogy of moving the house by pulling the nail. The problem is the house has gravity, which is forcing it to go down. When you're in space, you have no gravity, so the thing is just sitting there. I can't imagine it would take a lot of force just to move something in space. Am I wrong?
No, there's still gravity in space.
No gravity in space. That's why I'm saying it's just sitting there.
There is gravity in space. So
yes,
of course there's gravity in space. So the whole thing is that the the moon's being pulled towards the planet.
That's the problem.
But it's in orbit around the planet, and as a result, what you have to do, you have to effectively perturb that orbit in a way that kind of puts it into a stable orbit. Now, what you'll end up with is that if this thing has spiraled inwards, and by the way, most orbits are. If you do the math, most orbits are stable to permutations, so that if you get hit by a comet, you are locally, you're locally stable, which means that you can like wobble a little bit on your orbit, go out a little, come back in a little, but you'll always effectively return to this like nice central state. You have to be hit very, very hard to get knocked out of orbit. So it's not the case that one could assume that if you just hit a rock very hard, then it's going to be knocked out of orbit eventually. But it doesn't work like that. It's actually that things in orbit are actually in a stable orbit. So in order to be knocked out of orbit, you actually have to have applied a lot of force to get it out of orbit. And then the big problem is that in order to get back into orbit, you kind of have to push it up this big kind of gravity well and then back into this stable orbit position. So I suppose it's pretty, yes, it will be pretty harsh, but I actually think they do a relatively decent job at kind of trying to explain that, with the sole exception of the delta V, or reckoning the delta V is in meters per second, because that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you understand what Q was saying about a celestial object coming with near right angles to the plane of the something or another? Did you get that?
Yes, and it's nonsense.
Aha! I knew those, Q. They're all liars.
It depends. It depends. Let me just back up a little bit. So all he's saying there is that you've had you have a plane. So the way that the solar system orbits, or the way that the moon is orbiting the planet, it forms like a plane, so a two-dimensional plane. And what it's basically saying is that something has gone off, at a right angle to that, and has somehow affected it. Now, that may or may not be true, but if we're talking about it being affected in a gravity way and having the gravity as the force that has affected it, that would lead it to be falling out of its orbit in a different way. What it looks like here is that it looks like it's spiraling closer to the sun, closer to the planet. So to me, that doesn't sound like a reasonable explanation. Unless, of course, we're talking about some type of, fuzzy other kind of field that might have pushed it closer, but it wouldn't be gravity.
So it's probably going to.
But it doesn't matter.
It's probably going to drop out of orbit again someday in the future, so they're going to have to keep coming back and fixing it. Unless Q did something to make it stay there from now on.
No, I think once it's in a stable orbit, it's fine.
Okay. All right. Guys, Chris, anything?
This is just nonsense. There's no reason. The science of this particular episode is. It's fine in my opinion, but also it's just so not important. I don't think that's what this episode is about. I mean, this is about. I think I like this episode a lot, by the way, and it is when Q, I think he in a rather disparaging way refers to Data as being the robot that teaches everyone how to love or teaches everyone humanity. I think a lot of this episode is that, and that's kind of why I love it a little.
A little. Chris, anything?
I think I have nothing on the science, but I certainly think that this episode is fantastic. And I think it's fantastic because there are so many quotable elements. Like, have you eaten any good books lately, Ben? It's something I would just throw out there to someone randomly because it's just great. And Q is maybe at his most fantastic here. I'm not sure if I can say that. I haven't watched the last seasons of TNG lately. But when I rewatched this for this show, I was like, wow, Q is super quotable, quippy, just laying it out there, and I love every minute of him on screen. So this episode is really carried, in my opinion, by John DeLancey.
Let me back you up there. I'm going to go out on the limb, and I think this is Q's best, like most over-the-top performance. I mean, this is the Q at his most, you know, Q-ful, I suppose. I think you do get good performances, and you certainly get good performances in my mind in Tapestry and in All Good Things, but they were always slightly more dialed back because of the, frankly, because of the story. And in particular, in All Good Things, Q is kind of, you know, wound in a lot more, and whereas here he's just, you know, this is really you know, Q at his most over the top, but in a good way. And I really do enjoy the performance. I think this is we've not had that many Q episodes so far. We've had Encounter at Farpoint and Hide in Q, which really isn't a good foundation to cement this character. And then in Q Who, he was also very, you know, a lot more serious. So I'm actually thinking that a lot of the Q-like performances that come later and the kind of the humorous stuff certainly has its foundations in this performance.
Yeah, you know, now that we're being serious, I agree with you all that this is an excellent episode, and it's not excellent so much in the way what the story is per se. It's this is one of those episodes that's excellent because of the development of a character that we had not known before, but had deeply desired to get to know. This is the first time and the only time that we, quote, developed the character of Q. Chris earlier brought up Deja Q, Q in the Gray as you know, ripping on me a little bit there. But the reality is that episode tried to further develop the continuum, not the character. This is really the only episode that we learn about Q per se. Outside of that, Q is helping us learn about ourselves. And insofar as that, we don't learn much about him outside of what we wish to kind of imagine him to be. In here, we're told a lot about who he is. We're shown a lot about who he is as his personality. So when we think about this, about all the characteristics of Q, this episode is what guides our thinking in it. And that is what makes it such a great episode. It takes one of the most iconic characters of Star Trek and brings him, you know, fully fleshed out to life. And by the way, it's not eating good books lately, Chris. It's Worf's initial thing. Or Q says, "What must I do to prove, you know, my intent or that I'm human?" And Worf just
die.
Says, die. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, but it's the truth. I mean, what more proof? What could he do other than die to prove that he is not playing around? That is all Q could do. In the end, this episode is excellently written, which, you know, all great episodes are excellently written episodes, too.
Okay. All right. Well, when we find out what the problem is, Riker tells Mr. Worf to contact all ships in the sector for relief efforts. Right? So I'm going to let you guys decide. What should we talk about? The fact that no other ships ever show up? Or the fact that Q appears on the bridge completely naked, hanging in midair, and then falls to the ground. What would you rather talk about?
This seems like a trick question, Lou. Like, obviously, the more interesting thing is Q hanging naked in the air, but are four guys really going to say Q hanging naked in the air?
I'll follow Ben's lead. Go ahead, Ben.
I think it is an excellent way of grabbing the audience attention. So when it comes to what makes episodes great or memorable, actually, is probably the better way. So what cements them as a favorite in our minds, it's those moments where, you know, you first watch it, you don't, you know, it's humdrum. Oh, here, you know, it's anomaly of the week. There's no ships in the quadrant, typical Star Trek, you know, type deal. You know, we're going to solve this problem. And out of the blue, out of nowhere, appears Q naked on the ground, and he's got that, you know, just S-eating grin on his face. And you go, wait a second, I've never seen Q naked. Every other time he's shown up, he's fully adorned in some outrageous costumes. He's the center of attention in a way that is by his choice. And here you go, you're just surprised by what occurs. And so you have to watch the rest of the episode. You are compelled to watch. Mm-hmm. You're forced to watch. It is one of the best openers simply because of that 5 seconds where he drops on the ground naked.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say, I agree. And one thing that Next Gen sometimes did poorly, and one thing you certainly get when you have John Delancey come in, is that, you know, when you see John Delancey in the credit, you know you're getting Q. And more often than not as well, it's, you know, John Delancey as Q comes up. As a result, I think there are a couple of the episodes that have Q in that you effectively see the credit before you see the dude. Mm-hmm. And to me, that just is ridiculous why you would ever do it like that. And there are a couple of really memorable teasers out there that have Q in, and this is one of them, as Q appears right as, you know, with the final shot. And I think, you know, Tapestry is another one where effectively he steps out of the light. And if you are going to have, you know, I think John Delancey is a great guy. He plays a great character that is always central to the episode. And when you have that, you really do need him to be introduced in the teaser and not, as you know, not read his credit as it comes up in the first few seconds. So I completely agree. I think this is a great way to start. And you are given the full sense of security here that it's another, you know, it's another anomaly of the week. It's another, hey, how are we going to solve this problem? And then bang, it's, you know, that gets put relegated to the B plot.
Yeah, I think this is where the writers recognize, like, we've been doing this similar thing over and over and over again for the first 2.5 seasons. And not exactly the same thing, because, I mean, you guys have been doing this regularly, but I listen to your show, and I listen to another show that covers TNG, and I watch it along with it. And as I'm going through, I'm like, TNG is relatively, like, formulaic. They follow this good formula that they're figuring out as they go along. And this one definitely breaks that formula to an extent. And you're like, oh, thank God I don't have to watch these ridiculous small-mouthed aliens complain and fuss for the entire episode. So I was definitely excited as soon as John Delancey showed up. So, yeah.
Okay. All right, so Q drops to the floor and he says, red alert. Am I the only one that thinks that red alert should have actually happened? It seems like anybody can call red alert. Maybe because he didn't say
about
it right.
The computers. Are you speaking about the computers hearing his voice and, you know, jumping to red alert?
Right. Because I always thought that, especially on the bridge. I mean, if Deanna had said red alert, would it actually have done it, or just said, no, you're not somebody worth listening to?
And so in my desire to quell all nitpicks, I must say this, because I never thought about it in my life before, but it instantly comes to my mind. Of course, the computer would only recognize senior authority in which that is allowed to, you know, call disaster. Does that make sense? So only the captain, only the commander, the first officer, only the senior officers on the bridge crew are allowed to call red alert, you know, by policy and procedure. So therefore, the computer will only recognize their voice imprints and give that, you know, command out. You know, in this world, in this realm, in this universe, technology supersedes human error. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to let some blue-shirted dude, you know, some blue-shirted crewman come on the bridge and yell fire in a theater, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to, the technology will...
Except,
you know, be a failsafe against that.
Except, Rogar Danar was able to drop a security force field simply by tapping their crew member's badge with his own hand and saying "drop force field" on here, here, and here. Obviously,
episodic television, man.
Yeah,
episodic.
Oh, that's right. That was last week. And before, yeah, forget it.
And not to mention, you're referencing an episode that Chris and I haven't gotten to listen to yet, so we don't know your review. But that's a great episode, and that dude's a super soldier, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on, you got to give him the benefit of the doubt. He's like Captain America.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. Yeah, he was awesome, but he still was able to drop a force field. So, and you know, the force field that Worf just put up, and Worf didn't get a chance to say, "Wait, no, don't be dropping my force field." But okay.
Let it go, man.
Let it go.
Just let it go.
These aren't my colors.
The funny thing is that's my response to all nitpicks. Just let it go, man. Like, really, it's entertainment at the end of the day. Why are we nitpicking it? If it's entertaining, it's entertaining.
I'm sorry, but by the way, that brings up something interesting to me. So at my school, and cut this out, Lou, if you wish, but I just got to say this. You one time, Lou, Wesley Crusher, like the first season, I think he goes, talks about picking nits. Mm-hmm. And you're like, what's up with picking nits? Like, what is that? And all that nonsense. And I realized, like, just recently, because the school sent home, like, some memo to us parents that there's been lice found at the school. And in the memo, they start talking about, like what we're supposed to do in order to make sure our children aren't getting lice. Mm-hmm. And they talk about nits. That nits are like the growing larva or whatever of lice. Mm-hmm. And I realized all of a sudden what the entomology of picking nits comes from. The idea that you, in order to make sure all the lice are gone, you have to go through and pick the nits out, which is an incredibly arduous, tedious, horrible process that requires, you know, intense scrutiny and overanalyzation of every single hair and follicle and this, that, and the other. So that's what nitpicking is. It's a ridiculous, tedious, mm-hmm. overused, exacerbated attempt to try to find fault.
Do you have a?
And I was like,
do you have a boy or a girl? Yeah.
A boy.
Well, there you go. Cut his hair down.
Almost nine.
Cut his hair down to 1/8 of an inch, and you've got it done. But I have a girl, and unfortunately, that ain't possible.
I'm just gonna let it fly, man. Just let it fly. I'm not picking this, dude.
Not happening. Ain't gonna happen. No. So Q's looking for sanctuary on the ship, as dreary as that might sound. What do you guys think Q did to deserve this? Just the fact of being himself, or did he do? What do you? I guess we have to speculate what the final straw was.
Well, this is an interesting thing, because at the end he gets back in for doing one act of, like, selflessness.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree. It's interesting. I'd like to know what everybody else thinks.
I don't have a thought.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing to think, because obviously it may have been some kind of selfishness, or maybe he misplaced another asteroid belt or another race or something.
One thing I have noticed, though, is that the Doctor puts a lot more thought into these episodes than we do.
Mm-hmm. Doc, anything?
Well, actually, I think I'm going to take that as slander. I don't think so. I just always assumed that it was just Q being Q and doing whatever he usually gets up to. You kind of also get the impression, well, with the conversation between him and the other Q at the end, that pretty much the continuum or the guys that are judging Q aren't really that much better than he is anyway. Mm. In terms of, you know, the stuff that they get up to, and so it almost could have been just a simple falling out with, you know, just a slight clash of a personality one day. I didn't get the impression that there was a huge sin that he would have to kind of consider and then repent and then learn stuff from. So I just thought it was just, you know, pretty much a throwaway kind of a slap on the knuckles.
So they're treating him like a scapegoat, in other words, like all the sins of the continuum being thrown onto Q here, and, you know, they're washing themselves of that by ostracizing him from the place.
Yeah, to an extent, maybe. But again, it doesn't really, you know, it's interesting to think about what could have been the final straw, but it's not really that important in terms of the actual, you know, the actual show. We do know that there's no kind of, you know, lasting impression on Q, that he has to kind of repent or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So it's just that he's ended up in this position through whatever, and it's not that there's, you know, he hasn't you know, killed anyone, or he hasn't gone and done anything horrendous. So it's, yeah.
So then I'm curious, why, you know, now that we know future events and we know somewhere on in the Delta Quadrant there's another Q tumbling around in an asteroid somewhere, why couldn't they have just done the same thing to him?
Well, obviously that dude asked to become an asteroid rather than to become a human, perhaps.
No, I mean, he wanted to die. I mean, that Q wanted to die, and that's the reason why they had to keep him safe in an asteroid so he wouldn't kill himself. But obviously, this Q doesn't want to die, so making him human is okay.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Ben, anything?
Nope.
Okay. Perspicacity incarnate. So I looked up that stuff. Perspicacity, acuteness of perception, discernment, or understanding. And incarnate, embodied in flesh, given a bodily, especially a human form. A devil incarnate. So can somebody explain to me why he tossed out perspicacity incarnate? Because looking at those meanings, it doesn't make sense.
So who did he say it to? I've forgotten.
Worf. Because, you know, he was telling him to go back where he came from or something.
Oh, I mean, I think he was just being ironic then. You know? He was being wasn't it the case that this was when he was trying to figure out, you know, whether or not he was indeed human, and wasn't it directly in response to the idea of, you know, what would it take for you to accept that he's now mortal?
Right.
So I just thought that he was, you know, it was basically just thrown back as a bit of an insult.
Yeah, exactly. I just didn't quite understand what it meant. Yeah, because I believe he was in the brig at the time, or somewhere around there.
I'll say this, Lou. To analyze line by line, you could do that in this episode, and you could be fulfilled throughout that process.
Yeah, I know that, but I'm just trying to. I didn't understand it. Because he's.
No, I understand.
Let me set it up. What I just went back and reviewed, and he just asked him, you know, can I ask you a very simple question? If I still had all my powers, why would I allow you to just lock me up like this? And Worf said, you know, you've fooled us enough in the past, and that's when he popped out this perspicacity incarnate. And I didn't quite get what it meant.
What I think, so from the time that Worf takes him and transfers him to the brig, the entirety of that scene's intent is to do one of two things. I mean, our crew is not going to trust Q for any reason whatsoever. I mean, Worf put it plain and simple. What must I do? Q asks. Worf says, die. I mean, that is what it takes. It's going to take that, or it's going to take time and consistency. One or the other. And that's all talking about trust, which a lot of this episode talks about, the idea of what trust is. And we can get that later. But I think the intent of this scene is simply to show that Q is a child. Mm. As he's walking with Worf and he's running his mouth, Q, that is running his mouth, all I see is, I see my boy, my 8-9-year-old boy, you know, asking 1,000 questions that should be painfully obvious if you had 5 seconds of patience to observe what is occurring. And to tell me everything he thinks and everything he knows, and to try to convince me of what he wants to do is the right thing, yet I'm just walking with him patiently to what we're going to do, because that's what I've made my mind up. That's what we're going to have. That's what's going to happen, because I have more wisdom and more experience than he does. And so I understand what must occur in order for him to learn his lesson. So I think the intent of the scene really is simply to show this omnipotent, omniscient being is nothing more than a child when it comes down to it. When you take away everything he has, when you take away all his toys, all his powers, all his possessions, everything, he's just a little child. It's a way for us to begin to start to identify with Q. It's a way for the writers and are showing us, look, they're trying to get us to build sympathy for him. They're trying to get us to understand and get on Q's side. Because in the end, we either get on Q's side and want him to succeed, or we don't. And if we don't get on his side, this episode fails, and nothing is gained from it, and it's a terrible episode. But the fact that we all think it's a great episode kind of tells me that we all eventually end up on Q's side. We are rooting for him to succeed, in other words. And this scene is, that's what the intent of it is.
Okay. Okay.
It's a beautiful scene, by the way. It really is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so Briel 4 has been begun evacuating people from the coastal areas. Do you guys, I mean, you know, when we evacuate an area now, you see lined up cars all the way down the interstate or whatever. But, I mean, don't you think do you believe the evacuation would have been pretty simple and quick in the 24th century? Massive beaming from one area of the planet to the other? Anyone? No one?
Bueller?
Bueller?
You know, be surprised how many times I have to take out these pauses because no one wants to speak up.
I mean, so,
I got nothing here, man.
You're not giving the impression, right, that there's any major kind of public disturbance or anything like that going on, you know, on the ground. And in a season or so, we have Devil's Due, where it's a similar situation where there's a potential threat that is going to hit the planet, and there they make it explicitly very clear that, you know, public order is falling to pieces. And this was even before it crystallized and it became nothing more than a few tremors here and there. So you're led to believe that everything is going relatively smoothly, and, you know, whether it's, you know, beam out or whether it's just a very orderly queue, it's not integral to the story.
No.
And it kind of gets very much parked alongside, which is, in a way, I don't know. We spoke briefly about the two scientists that show up on the screen. Now, I think this episode, in probably more than others, you know, we have been often dealing with, you know, heads of states of the planet or, you know, important people. Here we're talking about two scientists. It doesn't come across as very high stakes. I know they keep reassuring us that this is going to lead to the next ice age and it's going to be disastrous for the planet, but it's not played in a way that you particularly care about them. And I don't know whether that was a conscious decision they took to focus the light off away from the planet and keep that as an abstract threat, and, you know, allow Q to come into the story as the main driver, or what. But I generally think that, you know, it's a very theoretical situation down on the planet, and I think the closest anyone gets to really caring about it is Geordi when he gets a little frustrated with a Q.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question, by the way. It seems to be like whenever we had this crisis, they're always talking about thousands of people or millions of people. Do you think that we would care more if they started using larger numbers that we can relate to more as like the population of Earth, a billion people? Or, you know, take it one step further, a trillion?
So if there was a station of five people, and would we care as much?
Well, so they say on this planet, well, I find it completely absurd that this planet only has a few million people on it. I mean, just knowing that our planet has, like, whatever, 6 billion or something.
Actually, it's something I think we've brought this up before, but most planets that you run into, most civilizations you run into, they are not large enough. You end up with thousands of people, or tens of thousands, or you know, a couple of million, but you very rarely run into planets that have, you know, 7 or 8 billion people, or perhaps, you know, what you'd expect Earth to be like in the 24th century. Mm-hmm. And I think that they consciously do this so that, if you think about the kind of the story this is really analogy for, it's a bit of, you know, I think people find it easier to relate to kind of country-sized populations in a way. So when you're watching it on TV and you watch it, you know that, you know, there's a planet somewhere that has, you know, a couple of million people that are a little bit funny. I think it allows them to have the story to really project out whatever's going on, you know, in the real world about a country that might have a million people, or it might be a city that has 10,000 people, or whatever it happens to be. So I think that it's very goes against the world that they're actually living in. And I think I don't know if it's intentional or not, but effectively it kind of projects it down to what the audience would be able to handle.
I think, give yourself credit, James. I had never considered that aspect of it before. It has to be intentional in that situation because it's too consistent. You are right, though. They are trying to guide us to empathize with a particular country, a particular race of people. I mean, we already said these people are Japanese through and through. Tsunamis on Japan, things of that nature. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I'm glad you added your perspective to that, because I would not have seen it that way otherwise. It's a good way.
I mean, in addition to that, right, at a certain point, you know, to misquote someone, when they talk about, you know, hey, you know, one death's a tragedy, a trillion is a statistic. After a while, if you were to say, you know, 2 trillion people, I think it kind of loses a certain amount of, you know, people don't have the ability to kind of scale up appropriately.
There's that too, of course, yeah.
Okay. You know how it's always been a running joke about having Riker's crotch in Data's face? Did you guys notice that he got the double crotch this time? Both Riker and Picard?
I didn't.
Now, you see, Ben, that may be technically considered picking a nit, but you gotta admit, as far as nits go, it's a pretty darn good, funny observation.
Well, I love jocularity, Lou, and those are one of my favorite ones. The Riker maneuver is up there with my favorite nitpicks. I mean, he does all but swing his hips into the man's face. I mean, constantly. I mean, why did Jonathan Frakes make that decision as an actor? I mean, what was he thinking? Like, here, this is, I mean, I'll never understand that. The minute somebody brought it up, I went, oh my gosh, it is, he does it all the time. He does it all the time. And it's like, now that it's brought up, I can't but always see it. It's rude. You know, thank goodness Data's an android, so he doesn't take offense to it.
Okay, so now, anyway, Q is in the brig, and there's obviously a brig worker, I guess you could say, security officer in the brig, who's probably playing solitaire at the time. You know, I think I asked that question many, many years ago, is what does a guy in the brig do when the brig is empty of prisoners? And we even came up with a few suggestions way back then. But today, I think this guy needs a little bit of follow-up training. Because if you notice, as the ship was being probed with a big white light, there's a little ball that's hovering around Q. I mean, it actually goes through a force field. This security guy sees it, but doesn't report it. At least I assume he doesn't report it. Does that make sense? Did you guys notice that? He actually watched his ball light go through the buzz through the force field and hover over Q. And next scene, we have Picard walking into the brig, and the guy didn't say a word about, you know, hey, I just wanted to let you know.
But this is just a nitpick suggesting that anyone other than the named staff is incompetent on the Enterprise, and that's certainly true.
Yeah, we know they're not really. They're all smart. They all earn their commission.
No. Yeah, but they might not be ready. You never know.
Okay. Oh, well, maybe. I mean, he just watches this thing and doesn't say anything. Or maybe he did report it, put it in the log, and nobody's read it yet. But okay, how about this nit? Q doesn't know what sleep is.
Yeah, why would he? He didn't sleep.
But he's been observing humanity and humanoid species for...
No, but I think he's talking experientially. He doesn't know what sleep is, right? Like, that's what I assumed anyway. That he knows in his mental framework what sleep is, quote-unquote. Like, he's read about it. Like, I know what, I don't know, snake venom and shooting snake venom out of my teeth is. But... I've never experienced it personally.
Mm.
So, I don't know. That's what I assumed when I heard the line.
Okay. But in the end, Picard decides to put Q to work in engineering, no less. So, it's a good spot for him. But he knows moons of all sizes. Big ones, little ones.
Yeah, this whole line, I was waiting for the... to drop, you know, when he was like, yeah, I know all about moons, and then he just drops trow on the guys talking to him, you know. Anyway.
Yeah. I figure he's probably mooned many people.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's why these guys are after him, right? Because he mooned them in the way that the Q moons people.
Okay. I gotta ask this question. Now, of course, this may be a nit, but again, it's one of those that I'm asking because I want to know if I'm right. Dr. Crusher comes off a turbo lift in engineering. But isn't that the same door that Data and Geordi go into to find where that flute plane was from? I mean, I thought that was a Jeffrey's tube. Does that make sense when Lessons, I believe it is, season 6?
Yeah, that's way too small a nit for me to even notice. So,
but I think you're right, Lou. I think you are. I don't think it.
Okay, so it's not
because this is the main table section, and this is. I don't think this is a. Who's to say that Dr. Crusher actually did come through a turbo lift? Though she might have just been hanging out in the Jeffrey's tube.
Oh no, it was a.
That's a cool idea. Maybe we could make a sitcom about her hanging out in the Jeffrey's tubes. Like that's what she did on her free time. She just crawled around in Jeffrey's tubes with whatever was in the Jeffrey's tubes.
Really?
Yeah, avoidant work. That kind of stuff.
So Dr. Crusher was a layabout is what we're coming up with now on the Battle Bridge.
Yeah, but I could tell you for sure, I'm looking at it, it is definitely a turbo lift. But I guess most people actually come into engineering from out around the corner getting off a turbo lift. Nobody ever has gotten off one right there, but okay, yeah, it doesn't matter. I'm just wondering. I believe that's you rearranged in the future.
I think, though, Lou, like there's a seed of interest for all of us, right? Because we're huge fans of the atmosphere of Star Trek. So I think even though we're calling this a nitpick, what you're saying right now, like it's just stuff that maybe you notice as you delve deeper into the episode because you just love the atmosphere of the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, wait a second, didn't I see that particular bit of what I would call quote-unquote the atmosphere in this episode before, and it was something completely different. And you want it all to make sense internally. And so that's the kind of nitpick that I'm actually okay with, because that's like, I'm a huge fan, and I want this to make sense because I want to walk around this spaceship myself.
Right. The thing is, I'm looking at these episodes as we do them in a different eye than ever before, because you know we're actually analyzing these things, and it just hit me that wait a second, I don't recall ever having a turbo lift there. It's always been his office or maybe a bathroom or a Jeffrey's tube, but it just came out of nowhere, and I thought maybe it's just me.
No, I think you hit on something that's consistent amongst fans of this series or whatever. The idea that we all wish to exist in this universe. Mm-hmm. And I don't see anything wrong with that per se. I think I see the nitpicks of this nature boil down to the fact that we understand reality is what we exist in. So the life we live, the world we're in, this is our reality, and we know that is true. We can't deny that. Yet we want something more, and Star Trek gives us the appearance of something better and more that we can achieve or strive for. And I see these types of nitpicks as a way of checking ourselves, going, no, this is not reality. This is just a television show.
Oh, yeah.
Look, it's not perfect. You know, I think it's really, actually, I think it's a good thing that people go into these sorts of things.
Yeah.
I agree with Chris. These are the types of nitpicks that I go, yeah, you know, cool. I mean, I never noticed them, but mm-hmm. That's because I'm just not that type of, this is not my personality.
Yeah, we all know.
I'm not that observant.
We all know Brian Denimore's not a real Klingon. Even he knows it, really.
Oh, I don't know, man.
I'm not sure. I thought he was. Are we? You're crushing my illusions currently,
I've,
Lou.
I've seen him after really his surgeries. He looks like any human, but I could be wrong. I mean, you know, he's maybe one of those foreheadless Klingons.
He could have had that Cardassian-like treatment to make him look like a human, you know? Like, isn't that the whole thing with the Cardassians? They can turn themselves into anything.
Mm-hmm. Get rid of all those bones. Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so, now sensors are picking up an angry cloud that's here to collect an old debt from Q, and Guinan calls them the Calamarain. Count 2-4, Calamarain, then 3 more.
Count 2-4.
Oh, wow, we went in, like, 2 different ways with that.
Calamarain.
The cloud was Vedra in my mind, and in your mind, it was the game-playing species from Deep Space Nine.
The difference between an auditory learner and a visual learner.
Nailed it.
The only thing is, I'm surprised no one on this call has said, but Lou, it's actually Alamarine count to four.
None of us are nitpickers, bro. None of us are nitpickers.
Yeah, but hasn't Upper Pylon gone through that episode by now?
I sang it a million times, but that's the thing. Like, you were making a joke. I recognize it as a joke, and I'm cool with it as a joke.
That is funny. I'm serious. I cannot wait till we get to that episode. The very serious question has to be, why wouldn't the actors have said, I'm not doing this? But
it's because they're getting the dollars. They're after the Benjamins, baby. I mean, come on. You will sell a lot of yourself for a few bucks when you're starving.
Yeah.
I feel like Kira did that, though. The actress, whatever her name is. She did that. She was like, whatever, I'm done. She didn't really act in that episode at all. She was just so frustrated and...
Uh-oh. This is let that happening.
Be her muse.
Yeah, this.
No, she had a good face on. Certainly during that scene, Nana Visitor.
Yeah, her
during the scene of this episode.
Wait, what episode are we reviewing?
Wait, what? Where are we?
Okay. So did you like the way the security guard shoves Q out of sickbay?
Wait, did we miss 10-4 already?
Huh?
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about. I did go back. Wonderful fork and...
Oh, man, that was beautiful.
As a lifelong lover of Whoopi Goldberg, seeing her chew the scenery with John DeLancey, Lou, I know you're a little more conservative than I am, and that's fine. And so, in real life, Whoopi Goldberg may not be your favorite person, but Whoopi Goldberg... is amazing here in this scene.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean she seems a little different in real life, but in these episodes I absolutely love Guinan. And go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, the acting aside, because Whoopi Goldberg is awesome, and the scene on first viewing is about the hilarity of their interactions.
Uh-oh.
I know. I just heard that too. Must resist going to check on disaster. Okay.
Yeah, until the next one drops.
That's right. It's a screaming, a bloody murder that I listen for.
Yeah.
But as all parents know. But no, it's the... what I enjoy about this is that it's a child teaching a child. So it's Data teaching Q here. Guiding Q. I find that interesting because... You know, you guys have really gone on and on about the fact that Data hasn't really matured out of his childhood into adulthood. But for me, Data will always be stuck in perpetual childhood. He's not, in my mind, capable of reaching beyond that understanding. So he's never going to become an adult. So I kind of put that aside. However... I enjoy Data teaching Q. I don't really know why per se, but I find it interesting.
Now, Ben, you said something there that I want to approach for a second. You said that these two are childlike. I would describe Q as petulant at times, but I would never describe Q as childlike overall. So can you clarify?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking for a clarification, because often it's required. We in this world like to nuance what a child is. So we like to add nuances and gray areas to things. But at its most basic, there's only two types of people. There are children and adults. You go, well, wait. What about that middle area, you know, of adolescence, which is what you're really kind of calling Q. He's an adolescent through and through. I mean, they show us over and over and over again that he is, like you said, petulant and all those things. That is the description of a teenager, right? Or of an adolescent. But an adolescent is just the more experienced child, a child with most of its innocence taken from it. But it's the difference in child and adult is a difference of understanding. Now, the understanding doesn't come through experience it doesn't come. So in other words, it's not about wisdom or any of that, those sorts of things. It's a choice. Data's not, in my mind, capable of making the choice because he is a slave to his programming. He was programmed by a person to be what he is, a set potential that cannot be exceeded, regardless of what we wish to think. Q is capable of, has an unlimited potential, as all humans do, but he is by no means an adult. He teases, he plays games, he argues. Only children argue, by the way.
Oh, come on now. Come on now. I don't know if I buy that. Only children argue? Really? Like, I feel like adults all throughout history, like, if we look back all throughout history, adults have always argued.
Now, that's a great thing. See, in there, what I understand by what you say there is that you don't truly understand what it is to be an adult.
Oh, come on now.
You wish to argue. You wish to argue. Yes. But I will not. I will not argue.
That's fine.
Because I know I don't have to argue. You don't have to tell me so. I understand, but I understand the difference. I fully understand. I truly have faith, Chris, that you will reach that potential as well. Because you have kids of your own. Your kids are a little bit younger than mine, so you don't have the full experience yet of seeing that those kids go from the innocent creatures they are right at the moment to watching them begin to lose their innocence outside of your control. And as they approach that age, as they begin to lose innocence outside, you know, they will go to school, they will have their peers, they will have other adults or other older people influence them. You will begin to realize you are no longer in control of those children. As a matter of fact, you never were. Because the only thing we can control are our own actions. That is what adults understand. That you cannot control anything outside of yourself. Once your body has been breached, the skin of your body, your hands, your understanding, your thinking, your feelings, your sight, all those things, once you realize that you have no control outside of that very small realm of existence, you begin to develop patience.
You've said a lot of things that I can't possibly go back and unpack all of the things you said. But as I trace my line back, the thing that I want to particularly hit on for this is the idea of argument being a symbol of childhood. In my mind, argument, and when I say argument, I mean like true argument, where it's me presenting a side and someone else presenting a side, and us then looking at both sides and considering both things as we go back and forth about the different ideals that would spring off of those different ideas that we both presented that seem to be in opposition. I don't think that argumentation is a symbol of an infantile nature or a childlike nature. I actually think that strong and good argumentation, or rhetoric, as it was called back in the day, is a symbol of maturity and a symbol of adulthood. And so that's what I ultimately want to parse out and argue. You said a ton of things, though, that I think there's a lot of good in there, and there's a lot of I don't know about that in there, but I don't think we have time to go into all of that.
Enough. Fair enough. But you're right. The most basic element is the argument, is the idea of argumentation. So when you have understanding, what that means is you know the truth. The truth is not something you argue with. So your opinion can be true or not based on your perspective, can be real or not based on your perspective. It can be real to you because you've experienced it. It can be real to you because you have the intellect to look outside yourself and empathize with others and their lives, their perspectives, their what they've gone through in life. But in the end, that is wholly separate. That is subjective. So how I break it down to brass tacks, this is the way I do it. There is some, there is what is true, there is what is real, and there is what is true. And you would go, but wait a second, they should be the same thing. However, I understand this, that things are only real once they occur. So in other words, things are only real once you have had experience. Experience is based on your senses, your sight, your touch, your taste, your smell, your hearing, things of that nature. The gathering of facts. So when you understand that facts are gathered through experience, so Dr. James Roberts looks through the microscope and he sees something, he records that thing, that becomes a fact because it's been seen and recorded by others. There is corroboration. However, those are still only based on experience. Yes, mutual experience gained by many people across the board, solidifies the facts as unarguable. However, facts do not breed truth. Truth is something you come to understand, and it's irregardless of facts or irrespective of facts, because it was always true. It didn't matter that you observed it. It was true, is true, is true forever and ever and ever.
Well, that's beautiful, because in this episode, it's all about Q, who has seen everything. That's and understands right. everything, ideally. And
No, has seen everything and has all the facts, has all the knowledge.
He knows what truth is.
He lacks understanding. He doesn't know the truth. That's what I'm pointing out.
Okay.
He has all the facts, but he doesn't understand. I can understand. I can know that 2 + 2 = 4. I can know that, but why does it equal 4? Why does it equal 4 is more important than that it equals 4.
So how could he still have an IQ of 2005?
IQ is just based on your physical talents of memory and the ability to store information. When you understand how IQ is measured, you understand derived whatever. You understand that IQ is nonsense. It is not matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't
matter. Well, it matters to someone like me.
It doesn't matter. Chris, if it mattered to you, then everything I say, you would not argue with.
Ben, is it matters to me as a professional because
IQ is how I discern
what kids need certain.
Sure, I get it. Then you would place me at the top of the class, Chris.
Maybe.
That's where you would put me.
All right.
No, but okay. I just mean for services, like on the lower end of the spectrum. Because there are kids, if you're above a certain level, you're right, it doesn't matter. But if you're below a certain level, it does matter. And we have to, parse that out. So I think that it matters in so much as it matters for those people who need to get.
However, would you ever say that those kids do not deserve the effort that you put into them?
Every kid deserves every effort.
That's right. That is the truth right there. That is the truth, irrespective of fact, irrespective of knowledge that 99.99 to the infinity nines of those children will not ever be worth, will not ever reproduce and make up, in other words, break even in effort. They will never be able to put forth effort into this world, into society, that which has been put into them. They will never equate. They will never make the world a better place based on the effort given and taken.
All right.
However, the truth is they deserve it because they are people. And you understand that truth. That is not about fact. That is the way you – that is your understanding.
Okay, guys.
So where were we in the episode?
Cut all that out. That doesn't matter. That was a personal conversation.
But I do know it's 9:30 over across the pond, so he's probably looking at midnight tonight. he's too sweet and nice to ever say anything like that, so I have to do it for him.
Okay, sorry.
Okay.
By the way, I do agree that IQ, I don't think, is a good measurement for on the intelligent side, on the upper side. I think it's a big fallacy that gets propagated around. And realistically, at a certain point, the difference between a the difference between a 125 and a 145 is pretty much nothing more than, you know, possibly how you hold your pencil and how quickly you can answer the question. It is a little bit silly, and how much practice, frankly, you've had in the type of questions you're going to be given.
But, James, that's because the truth is, will defeats talent every time.
Grit is what we call it today, but
yeah. Call it what you will. It is your personal will to succeed, your effort. Effort beats talent.
Hmm.
That's why it doesn't matter the difference between 125 and 142 or 145.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Now, does anyone here besides me believe that had Q been able to eat his 10 chocolate sundaes, that it would have been awesome if when he was in engineering and said, I have to go, I believe I'm lactose intolerant?
I think that would have been hilarious.
Finding out he's lactose intolerant.
The thing about Star Trek is that we don't get enough toilet jokes.
No.
And this could have been a great opportunity.
They missed out, man. Mm-hmm. They lost their chance. Mm-hmm.
You know, quite honestly, I'll tell you something. I'm going to give you a little bit of my final review right now, in the sense.
Oh, nice.
Because I believe the Brielle 4 situation, beyond, you know, something that Q may have had something to do with or maybe didn't have something to do with and in the end did solve, I could have done without all that. I would have liked to have seen Q just stripped of his powers and all these races coming after him.
Yeah, that would have been a great...
Oh, I think we could have had a whole episode.
A series all itself.
Yes.
Four or five episodes, really.
Right. Yes, exactly. And then, you know, just like Odo gets his... goo stuff back, you know. Q gets his powers back.
Odo gets his goo back.
Yeah, he gets his goo, his mojo.
Yeah, Odo gets his mojo back.
Yes, that's it. Okay, so, but okay, now we're gonna go ahead. Let's go into the possible solution that you know we have if we're gonna try and coax this satellite back ourselves. Did you guys think that maybe Geordi was kind of being a dick this episode?
Isn't he always? Really?
I never thought he always was, but in this one, yeah. The way, I mean, he's got Q doing such a minor job. It's like having the Hulk open up a soda bottle for you.
Now, Lou.
So, not a soda bottle, right? It's like one of those jars you can't get into in the kitchen. Having the Hulk stand there for the sole purpose of being able to open jars for you.
Yes. You know, Q's just sitting there like, Jesus, what am I doing here? But Geordi was just kind of being a dick.
I'm going to argue that Lou, from here forth, that is a character trait of Geordi. And I know you love him. I know you love him to death. But you're going to start noting that regularly as you go through the battle bridge, that Geordi is the battle for himself most of the
time. Mm-hmm. That's funny, the battle. We ought to start using that. We haven't used the sizzle in a long, long time. We've got to bring the sizzle back somehow. When somebody's
Sub Rose is coming. And there's a lot of sizzle in that episode, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm feeling kind of sick right now, and I got a feeling by the time that comes around in three more seasons that I'm going to be really crashing down. But I'll let the doctor handle it on his own because he loves Sub Rosa.
No, I don't think I've seen Sub Rosa in quite a while.
Are we going to get a techno track of the doctor saying, I'm that guy who likes Sub Rosa, like on
Simple? I've never... I don't actually remember he's in it. There's a lot of mediocre stuff at the end of season 4 in general. Sorry, at the end of season 7 in general. We'll see how it goes.
I've always thought that season 7 was a reason why it didn't have a season 8. But anyway, Geordi's a dick. Let's go past that now. So do you think the Calamarain could have maybe waited a little bit, let them help, let them try and fix that moon before they had to attack and take Q? Or try to take Q? And how come Data didn't go with them?
go with the Calamarain.
Well, I mean, because they were pulling Q up into the air, and obviously he was going to hit the top of the ceiling or go through it, and the Calamarain were going to get him, but Data's able to hold him back. Why didn't Data just go with him?
Okay, so we're at another nit, right?
I suppose.
So, let's say Q weighs whatever John DeLancey weighs, which is probably 180, 200 pounds, maybe 220, mm-hmm. if we're being mean to John DeLancey. Data, probably, with all his positronic metal and other bullcrap that's filling his innards, is, let's say, 400 pounds, maybe. So 260 is probably their limit. Let's go with that.
That explains it completely. I never thought of it.
You could also go on the fact that Q is human, right? Mm-hmm. So his cellular makeup is different than Data's. So in some way they're using some sort of attractive force that is based on Q's cellular makeup that Data is not part of. So they can't actually lift Data, because they're only attuned to the human makeup of Q. That's all nonsense, though, anyway. The real question is, why did they bring the Calamarain in? Why did they bring something to attack Q? That's the question that we had to ask, because mm-hmm. we have had no reason to trust Q up until this point. And Q is not going to die, because Star Trek doesn't kill people for the most part. Mm-hmm. And we kind of already all know that, right? Mm-hmm. So what do we do instead? We torture him. We show the audience that Q is incapable of defending himself from torture, because torture inevitably leads to death. We all understand that. So he would put a stop to it immediately, because nobody wishes to experience pain unduly. And this allows us to begin, well, allows our crew and the audience to begin to trust Q's situation, that he's telling the truth. Now that's why they're so, that's such an important part of the episode.
Okay.
So I quite like the fact that it's Data and Q that are put together in this episode by Picard, and the good thing that you have there is you have the ability of Q to acknowledge the fact that he isn't like Data, and he isn't he isn't going to someone's aid. And I think that the Calamarain attack allows you to see, first of all, you see how vulnerable Q is, and it allows us to bring ourselves forward and say, well, even though he's a bad guy, he shouldn't be tortured by these people, so we'll protect him. But then it also gives the flip of, Data's obviously a good guy. He's been learning this compassion stuff, and he steps in where Q wouldn't have done. And I think it's in the phraseology when he starts referring it, when Q himself even states that he wouldn't make a good human, I think that I think that the comparison with Data is very clear in the writing.
Okay. All right, so now, since Data was able to stop the Calamarain from taking Q, he's in sick bay, half torn apart, and now we get to the scene where I like the way the security officer just grabs Q and pushes him out the door. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I guess I said that, so I should go on to the next one.
Actually, I don't remember. When did he physically manhandle him? I mm-hmm. don't recall that.
Yeah. Yeah. Crusher says, everybody should just get out of here and let me work on Data. And Picard tells the security guard, keep Q with you. And he points at him. And next thing you know, the security officer just walks up, grabs him by the arm, and pushes him out the door. I thought it was funny.
Yeah.
So I missed that.
Okay.
I feel like all these scenes with Q being human instead of godlike are really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And they're played well. DeLancey plays them really well.
I think there's been a lot of kind of very quotable dialogue that has been, we haven't really touched on. I won't let it go without mentioning, the good stuff in the 10th Ford when he has to order the food is always good. And I do like it when I think he quotes saying that if you could speak to your captain, I would be eternally grateful. And then Andrew's breath says, which I acknowledge isn't as much as it used to be now that he's mortal. I quite like a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty nice and pretty tight writing in my mind.
Took everything in me not to sing Let It Go when you said that a second ago, Doctor.
Really? Okay.
Let it go. Let it go.
Let it go.
Didn't take that much.
Yeah, it's gone. Okay, so do you guys like the Q in the ready room scene, you know, wallowing in a little bit of self-pity?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Ben? He's learning the...
Well, I guess... I like it just in the sense that... I like the crew's reaction to it, I guess you could say. I don't really... not impressed by Q's wallowing in self-pity. Because by this time I've come to believe that Q cannot save himself as an audience. But I like that the crew is beginning to... For example, Data's advocating for him, and the crew is now recognizing that advocate and appreciating. So if Data's going to advocate for anyone, you must respect that. Because Data's not going to just, he's not pulled by emotions. He's only pulled by his the facts of the situation. And so when Data begins to advocate and defend Q, I like that the crew recognizes, the captain recognizes it. Troy specifically brings it up. I like that. I like the way they use the characters to guide our understanding. What James says, the writing is tight. The writing is airtight.
Okay. Okay, so let's see. Q is now human. He has no powers. And it just goes to show you again the tightness of the security on the Enterprise, that you can not only get into the shuttle bay, but get into a shuttle and get the shuttle out the door before anybody realizes that this is all happening. So,
yeah, I mean the writing might be tight, but the security isn't.
Nah, you know, you gotta figure. I'm curious what Mr. Worf's next appraisal's like. You know. Well, see, Mr. Worf, overall, you've been doing a great job. However, this guy got out of the ship. This guy was able to take over the ship. This guy was able to, you know, these are things you need to work on in the next year.
I will do that, sir.
So, but anyway. Poor Mr. Worf. Everybody shites on him.
I do want to kind of point out that there's a reason security is not, you know, what we think it should be, quote unquote. I mean, this is a place where all are trusted, right? I mean, that's what it is. It's the flagship. It's Starfleet. It's the Federation. It's humanity. We moved beyond these things of pettiness. I mean, you guys haven't got to the season, the episode yet, with Mark Twain, but as they point out, we moved beyond.
Sorry.
Right, no, you haven't, but we've moved beyond all these things. So there's no need to protect the shuttle bay because, I mean, why would anybody steal a shuttle? To what end? Are you going to get away from the Enterprise that can go warp 9.79?
No.
You know, it's the understanding of the futility of trying to breach security allows us to have a more lax initial security. By the way, I just like to point out, I worked at many airports over the years, and security is a huge farce. Mm-hmm. Once you have trust, once people trust you, once the security guards know your name and see your face, you can do anything you wish to violate the quote policy of security. It's a farce that we adhere to because we find comfort in it, but it's very childish. You know, in this universe, we've moved beyond those childish things. Mm-hmm. This need for having locks on every doors and having security codes for every access point. You know, why would anybody do these things? Hmm. Obviously, because they're not very mature.
Okay. All right, and now we got Corbin Bernstein. Is that how you Bernson. Bernson. Corbin Bernson.
It's Sean's dad. Sean's dad is what you can call him.
Who's Sean?
Sean from Psych.
Oh, okay.
Right, Ben?
No, I don't know that.
Sure. I've seen those.
I don't know that. But we have Corbin Bernson on, who actually was on L.A. Law with Kate Mulgrew, you know, just prior to her falling down the elevator shaft. So I thought that, you know, there's always these things with these... I don't know, what do you call them, 5 degrees of separation between Star Trek and Boston Legal and a few other things, but He comes aboard the shuttle to talk to Q, and that, you know, you're doing the cell. Oh, back up, Ben. No, I think obviously he learned that. Okay, you asked why would Q take the shuttle in the first place? Is that what you were asking? Something like that?
No, why would you protect the shuttle bay in the first place? Why would security care that somebody... Why would they even consider that somebody would steal a shuttle?
Yeah. I suppose. Yeah. I don't know. I suppose because he's not a prisoner. If he was a prisoner, then yeah, you'd want to protect it a little more from an escape. But I do like the idea. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. You do like the idea.
I do like the idea that Q realizes the Calamarine are going to do what they have to do, including destroying the ship to get to him. So... he learns lessons of humanity well when he decides that he's just going to separate himself and let them take him because they're going to one way or another.
So that's a great leaping board or a platform to leap off of.
Yep.
This episode is, as we've been building up to it, this episode is about really examining trust and what is trust. Even this episode tries to argue or to point out that trust is earned. They do it very subtly. However, when you think about what trust really is, the truth of trust, what that means, trust is not earned. Trust is given. And I think that's most exemplified in the security of the ship, actually. Funny enough.
That's funny because Worf does say trust has to be earned, not given away.
Yes, exactly. No. That's the line I would reference otherwise. Mm-hmm. But trust is not earned. To what end can Q earn their trust? Well, he can't because Worf said it specifically. What must I do to prove? To prove.
Yeah.
To earn. To prove. Same thing. Mm-hmm. You must die. Well, Q doesn't die to gain their trust. He is tortured, and eventually they observe enough to where the facts lead them to take a leap of faith. Because faith is belief without sight. They don't need to see Q die to know that it will happen. They believe it without sight. So they have faith that Q, what they do is they have faith in him, that he is telling the truth. They don't require him to prove it. They give their trust instead. And Q, this is what pushes Q to go and martyr himself, to take that step that would otherwise have caused him his death. He realizes that these people are so good inside. They're so loving inside. And he is so, as he said, such a coward. The difference between a hero and a coward is not bravery or skill or anything of that nature. The difference between a hero and a coward is love. A hero loves unconditionally.
Okay.
A coward has the smallest and most short of conditions in which to love. And that's the reality of what Q is. He can't love. He's not capable of it. He doesn't understand it. His innocence has been gone. He is omnipotent. He is omniscient. He knows everything. He has all power. He has no need to trust. He has no love. And humanity, as it is shown in Star Trek, especially on Next Generation, is loving unconditionally all that they encounter because they trust completely all who they encounter.
Okay.
And that's the reality of what this episode is showing us.
I'm not sure.
Of course not, because you wish to argue.
No, not because I wish to argue, because I'm not sure that faith is what this episode is trying to show us.
Okay.
I think this episode is trying to show us that selflessness, not faith, but selflessness is the end all be all.
And selflessness is this. What is the most selfless act? The most selfless act is to give your life.
To give yourself, yeah.
Greater love hath no man than to give his life. That's the truth, Chris.
All
right,
yeah.
Okay, guys.
I know it's the truth, and you don't argue.
Nope, don't argue, Chris, please. Okay, so Q's about to give himself up until Q2, I guess you can call him, or you just call him Q, shows up, and puts everything on hold because, well, you know, this little selfless act, he can't go back to the continuum. There'd be a lot of explanations and probably paperwork to fill out, so he gives him his powers back. And what's the first thing Q does? He takes a column of rain, turns him into a little ball, and threatens to pull their whiskers.
Man, that's not the first thing he does. The first thing he does, he changes his clothes.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. And actually, I think it's very... I think that's clearly done on purpose. You know, it's the symbol of, you know, Q regaining, you know, his previous position, and his previous position is that of a, you know, in this guise that we see him in, it's the Starfleet captain, and I think that was highly appropriate for to be the first thing he does.
Right, but did you notice Picard's look when he's back on the bridge?
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So, yeah, okay. So he threatens to pluck their whiskers, but Q, just seeing if you're listening. And the Calamari Moraine disappear. Wherever they go, I'd be curious to know. But then the shuttle disappears, and everybody believes, well, that's the end of Q. But, au contraire! So what do you guys think of the mariachi band that shows up? Normally, I don't like most Mexican music. No offense, but you know, sometimes it sounds like a cat barfing on an accordion.
You're crazy, man. You're crazy. As somebody who lives in Arizona and fully immersed in Hispanic culture, you got to appreciate that all music is beautiful.
Yeah, as somebody who lives in South Carolina, I'm actually with Ben on this one.
How about
yeah.
somebody who lives in the UK? What do you think?
I have no problem with the mariachi band.
Oh, that mariachi band was awesome. There was no accordion. I hate accordions. I don't know why, but but when you hear that...
So your real problem is accordion.
I think that's...
So your real problem is you hate Polish people.
I don't know about that. No. It's just the accordion.
He also hates Home Alone.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, you know, you stopped at a red light, and you have this guy next to you that's playing the accordion music, completely blasting it. It just...
Hold on. Lou, that's not the accordion that you're hearing. It's the tuba.
No, it's definitely the accordion. It's definitely the accordion that you can hear. So.
Yeah, I think accordions are awful as well, Lou. But I can often overlook that.
I will
for
know.
What else is in the
for a sweet bass line. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the mariachi band was pretty awesome in this particular episode. Now, let's talk about one of the final scenes since we finally got there. And that is what Q gives Data. Now, he obviously first thought, if your intention is to make me human... But couldn't he have made him human for about 10 minutes instead of giving him the laugh? Yeah. I think it would have been awesome had he been a human for the next hour. Because then if I was Picard, I'd say, Data, you're relieved of duty. Go out and experience a few things and come back in an hour. Because then he would really, truly understand if he really wanted to be human at that point. That hour could have been like, hell no. I had to tinkle three times. I tripped over something. I bumped my nose. The replicator really does make a bad Fungili.
I was barely fully functional.
Yes! Exactly. Yes. But the problem is, what little fully functional I was because I saw Wesley Crusher.
Oh, God! Oh, did you just turn that into a pedophilia joke, Lou? Really?
I think I might have. So, so I don't know.
Oh.
Okay, bring it back to reality. I think
snap back to reality. Snap back.
So I think an hour worth of being human would have been a whole lot better than having a 10-second laugh.
I don't know, man. I think actually, Lou, your statement there is telling. So I think the 10-second laugh was Q saying, this is all you need of humanity, right? So Q doesn't think humanity is anything special, and he's trying to show Data, you can have these few moments of pleasure in humanity, but that's it, because humanity is really awful. which is interesting with your statement, you know, about Wesley Crusher, which is not really funny, but it's actually kind of awful to think about if we think about it in real life. But when we're thinking about it in this sphere of fiction, it can be humorous, but it's not actually humorous because humanity is actually
pretty humorous. So let's take Wesley out. Let's say it was Riker instead of Wesley. I just popped Wesley out of my head, not even thinking of the pedophilia. He saw that slight bulge out of Riker's pajamas and became... Never mind. The point is...
No worries. Wesley's just Indian.
The sexuality is what you were talking about, Lou, right? It's the sexuality that you...
We found out that Data was gay. Okay? Let's go there.
Big deal, right? But, Chris, let's flip turn that upside down.
Please. Thank you.
I will all the way. I think you Carlton'd yourself there. In other words, I think you showed yourself, sir.
Did I?
I don't think that that's what Q is saying about humanity.
Maybe not.
I think that Q is actually, interestingly, well, he's shown to be obsessed with humanity. Which, why is he obsessed? Not because of their degradation and their the ills of who they are, but rather because of what makes them unique to all the other races of the galaxy, I guess you could say. Now, as that might be arrogant, know that we are the only living creatures in the universe, and that is a fact, but it's also the truth. What makes us special? That's the question. What makes humanity special? And they're trying to grasp that. They're trying to understand that, the writers themselves. And the way they try to get their hands around it is by showing you one aspect that makes us special. And special things do not need to be indulged. So Data doesn't need to go and eat chocolate and taste it. He doesn't need to go and have sex and feel an orgasm. He doesn't need to comb his hair and feel the tangible pleasure of touch. He doesn't need to hate. He doesn't need to love. He doesn't need to do any of those things. All he needs to do is have a moment of joy. And that's what Q gives him. Q says it. He says, let me give you something far more special. And he gives him 10 seconds of laughter. He knew Q. He knew Data. The one thing. What did Data say in the beginning episode is the whistling. He'll never quite be able to reproduce it. Why do you whistle? When do you whistle? It's when you're filled with joy. That's when you whistle. What Q gave him. He gave him a moment of joy.
Okay. I think you're right.
Okay, guys.
I think you're right. Essentially, I think there are some underpinnings that I disagree with, but we won't go into that right now.
What it is to be a human!
Make it a supplemental law.
Wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Raise your fist to the sky. Understand that you have a choice every day to be filled with joy or filled with hate. Make the right choice.
Okay.
Be filled with joy.
Got it.
Every day.
Every day. As much as possible. Okay, so I guess we're all done. The Brielle 4 moon has returned itself because of Q. Thank you very much.
Deus ex machina.
The what?
Que pasó? Muchas gracias.
Day of sex what?
I said deus ex machina, but yeah, day of sex would also be awesome.
Yeah, you know, poor Data, he didn't get that either.
I'm with it. I'm ready for a fifth kid.
Fifth, huh? No thanks. One's enough for me. Okay. So then I guess, Doctor, you've been quiet again because you've been chastising yourself for talking too much lately. What do you think? Anything you got?
I think technically Wesley's 18 in this episode.
Oh, thank God.
I think we're actually good.
Legal. God. No more pedophilia.
See? You guys take an innocent little thing. All right.
Yo, Lou, I've always understood. It's all good, brother. It's all good, man.
See, you know, that's another the thing you don't understand is I kind of like some episodes of Enterprise because the dog who plays Porthos is such a beautiful little thing.
Oh, God.
He is a cute puppy, isn't he?
Oh, it's a she. It was brief.
Are we going to,
yeah, they were.
So we went to pedophilia, and now we're going to bestiality.
Yes, see,
I'm a little lost.
Much better, more comfortable there, Sam.
Oh, Chris,
Breezy.
I hold my puppy in my arms. And I go, oh, puppy, you're so cute. I love you so much. Oh, kiss it and love it. Let him lick me in.
Then I'm just gonna say this. I'm just gonna say this. You can't kiss forever.
Well, can't argue with that.
Well, either way, Porthos was played by Prada and Breezy and Windy. So they were very beautiful beagles, and I am a dogophile. I do admit that.
I agree.
So,
they were beautiful.
Yes, I love dogs. I mean, tangent that Doc's not going to get to bed till later now because of. For many years, I refused to get a dog. I didn't want to deal with the pooping and the feeding or having to feed and getting too fat, taking to the vet, having to give them shots, and my daughter being mean to animals. I didn't want to deal with that. And then we babysat a dog for what was supposed to be 3 months and turned into 3.5 years, and now I cannot live without dogs. Cats, on the other hand, can't stand. Hate. But that's a different story.
Until you have cats and then they rub up against you.
No. We had a flood in our basement the same year we were here because a window wasn't secured properly, and the cat pee from that carpet in that room was so overpowering that I decided I will never get a cat ever. So, but that's
because cats belong outside.
Yeah,
but never mind.
Yeah, that's where they belong, not in my house. Okay, so it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of...
Jeez, are we here already, Blue? I'm so sorry.
That's okay, man. I knew this was going to be a very short show. On a scale of 1 to 5, or Ben's scale of 5 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being what Ben gives it, I think I'm going to go first. Yes, I am. I'm kind of sad that only one species came after Q. Forget the moon, forget the goofy-faced, small-lipped people in Brielle 4. Let's focus on who's going to be coming next for Q. That story could have stood all alone, not only for one episode, perhaps even the next three, or space it out to where Q could have been on for half a season. Having Guinan stab him, awesome, it was delicious, but it wasn't, you know, I wish we could have had more interaction with Guinan, because I do like Guinan. The Enterprise trying to move a moon was kind of, it's okay, it's silly. Like they said, it was an ant trying to move a tricycle uphill. Let's see here, what else do I have? This was a great use of Q. I find it very interesting that how he loses his powers, and in this one, for being a bad Q. But in the future episode with Q, he gets to be locked away because he can't handle immortality. So I do like where Q's are going. And actually, we don't get to see Q life until Voyager. So that in itself was an awesome episode. Can't wait till we get there someday, Doc. I like seeing Q having to deal with not being in charge anymore or making the decisions for himself, except for to sacrifice himself for the well-being of the crew. The needs of the many weigh the needs of the Q. So I'd say he grew up in this episode. I think this episode deserves a 4. Or a 5 for Ben.
Well, I'll go ahead and go next and give Ben the place of honor that he deserves at the very end.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, sir. I wish to have it.
Because I think this episode is also fantastic, Lou. And I think this episode answers the essential question of Star Trek V, the movie. What does God need with a starship? Well, sometimes you need the starship to protect him. Thanks, Q. And... I love this episode. I think this episode is funny. It's quotable. It is entertaining. You can nitpick anything and make it awful. And I have done that. I've nitpicked things. But I've realized in my quote-unquote old age of 30 years old that really entertainment is meant to be entertainment. Like, you're just supposed to be entertained by it and maybe called to question certain things about life, godliness, and society. And this episode does all of those things for me. It calls me to think, it calls me to be entertained, and it caused me to be happy. So I have to give this episode a 4.8 on my arbitrary scale of judgment.
Right now, Doc Brown. Fuck. Right now, Doc Roberts is going, these people in their 4..
That's all right. I'm manly enough to stand by my 4.8.
All right. Ben's a 5. Doc, what about you?
I mean, regarding the 4.8, I was listening to some of our shows a little while back, and I realized that for one of the shows, I gave it a 5, but I then gave the additional comment that it's a low 5, but it's still a 5. So, you know,
it's a 4.8.
Yeah. So, what, you know, a low 5 is just a 4.8, right? It's just that I don't like to be that specific on the numbers. So, okay, I like this episode. This episode is really good. I actually, until Ben kind of pointed it out, I hadn't at least consciously recognized or realized that this really is probably it is one of the few episodes that is centered around Q himself, rather than having Q as the tool under which we can like learn something about the rest of the characters. And I think in that respect, it's both unique and I think it is handled very, very well. I think that there's great dialogue and it's very well written. In particular, Q's performance as well is great as always. But you know, this is really, in my mind, this is a step above a lot of the other Q episodes that we have had and that we are going to be having in future. I actually find the idea of this setup of the planet to be fine. It doesn't really detract too much from the story, and I actually think it's specifically written in a way so it shouldn't detract from the main story. You also have it's around half the episode you have before you even have any threat to Q's life, and they do want to take the time to have, you know, the Data and Q show and have all of the funny observations about humanity. And I think that, you know, in a way, I suppose that's what Star Trek is, right? It is the at least that's what they do a lot. They do want to have something said about humanity, and they, you know, they use these fantastical characters as a way of being able to produce insights. I am generally kind of, you know, really positive about this episode. I think that it also is it's also good to have, you know, Q have this development. And yes, I suppose to a certain extent he gets reset by the end of the episode, but I like the journey that he's come on. And you also are given the impression that Q kind of does have a connection to the crew. It's not just that this is one of a billion crews that he happens to torment. There is a kind of special relationship between him and Picard, and that's at least implicitly acknowledged by the way that he turns up this week. And I don't think it's just because Picard has the largest ship that will protect him from the guys that are after him. I did have a couple of nitpicks here and there, but I don't think they're particularly relevant. I will throw one out now because we didn't have a chance to do it. But people have this tendency to throw around tachyons as particles of wonderfulness that can do anything. And the thing that was attacking Q clearly wasn't a tachyon. So I don't understand why they always fall back on that. But that's not important. I was going to come in at a 4 this week, but I'm actually thinking that it might be bumped up. I don't think that this could have been much better, frankly.
History in the making happening here.
So put me down for a 5 for this episode. Oh. Very enjoyable. And
what you mean is a 4.8, right?
No, I don't think a 4.8 quite works.
So this is a perfect episode.
It doesn't have to be perfect to be 5 out of 5.
Yeah, but perfect for you. Perfect for you arbitrarily.
No. Listen to what he says. No. Seriously, listen before you speak.
Mm-hmm. I hear screaming.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, but I think this is, you know, this is a great episode. I think I've always kind of considered my scale of the episodes to be, you know, instead of 1 through 5, I always like the idea of, you know, a thumbs down and a meh, and then 1 thumb up, 2 thumbs up, and 3 thumbs up. And I think this is a 3 thumbs up episode. So 5 out of 5.
I like it.
5 out of 5. And Ben and Chris averages out to a 4.9. Sorry, Ben.
Wait,
can
Ben's got a, he hasn't gone yet.
Oh, I know that, and I'm going to let him go, but I'm just telling you, we know what it's going to be. So, all right, go ahead, Ben. I'm sure you got something
to say. And that's intentional, because, you know, why wait to the end to say what you got to say?
Mm-hmm.
And, but I do think, though, that this episode doesn't really matter much. You hear it in the background, if you did before, you hear the screaming of joy that I'm missing out on while I'm on this podcast. And I do that only because, as much as I'd love to be interacting with what is going on outside, I do enjoy being here with you guys as well. And that balance is something that I appreciate needs to be kept in check. And I'm always drawn back to you. Okay. James, Lou, you guys do a wonderful job on this podcast.
You guys, hold on. They're overpowering you.
That's okay. They're allowed to.
Yeah, but you couldn't hear what you were saying.
And that doesn't matter.
Oh, okay.
Because what I have to say is it really does not matter. The reality is I enjoy listening to you guys every week. I'm so happy that you guys come on and put forth the effort to give me something to be entertained by. I'm glad that you guys go through every episode and look at them intently with scrutiny, so that I can see things I never saw before, hear things I never heard before, understand things that I would not have understood from my own perspective. I'm going to be eternally grateful. And that does mean a lot. It means more than what Q said, because my eternity eventually ends. So while my gratitude might end, you know my love never will.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you guys for coming on and doing this podcast. Thank you guys for being here and doing this thing. Thank you for having me as a guest. I appreciate it to no end. I look forward to doing season 3, season 4, season 5, 6, and even the horrible season 7. I look forward to speaking to you guys for the next few years to come. Thank you so much for having me on. James, Lou, you guys do a wonderful job. Chris, you crashed the party, brother, but it was so lovely to have you on, man. I love speaking with you, man. You light me up. You light me up, sir. Light me up. So thank you so much, guys, for having me on. Thank you for the audience for listening. I got to go back to my children, mm-hmm. to those who are not my children, and to the 18-year-old who can't but be a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I give this episode, The Inevitable, of course, 5 stars. Because at one point in time, it was perfect to you. It was the right thing at the right time. You saw that. That's right, buddy. Because you saw that teaser. You saw that teaser and it hit you hard.
Yep.
And you kept your eyes glued to the screen. And you listened and hung on to every single word. And for 45 minutes of your life, you dedicated yourself to understanding what they were trying to say. And that's why it's perfect. That's why it gets 5 stars.
Okay.
Thank you. Drop the microphone, I'm out! But no, I really do have to pee badly.
And he went and he did that just before we started.
That's right.
Okay, then. All right, guys. Hey, thanks for coming on. So,
next time on Star Trek The Next Generation, a brilliant scientist is killed and Riker becomes a murder suspect.
I just know he did it. He killed my husband.
Was it a crime of passion?
She's lying. That never happened.
Or a violent act of jealousy?
You're a dead man, Apgar.
We both know Will's innocent.
The verdict could send Riker to his death. On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Join us next week as we review episode 14 of season 3, A Matter of Perspective. And guess who we have on? Somebody, you know.
I'm not sure. Whose perspective are you going to have, Luke?
The scallywags, I'm certain.
I'm sure, yeah.
Some scallywag? Yeah, maybe.
Well, I know he's a carnivore, but I don't know what that means.
Well, lots of people eat meat, though.
Exactly. But this one, carnivore jerk, or Jay, which short for, I don't know. Hey, guys, real quick, I just want to mention that we're not going to have any forum feedback for this particular episode because we're going to do 2 of them in the next show. And actually, you're in for a treat there.
So look forward to the next forum feedback being something interesting, and it will have two shows.
All right, guys. Thank you for coming on, and we'll talk again, Chris, soon. Ben, the rest of the season, I believe, is spoken for, so start looking for season 4. We'll get it out there, and then sometime in the next 6, 7, 8 weeks.
I appreciate the invite.
All right, then. Take care, and good night, all. Mm-hmm. Say good night, James.
Okay, good night. I don't need to say good night, though.
Yes, you do.
Good night, James.
Good night, James.
Good night, James.
Oh, yeah, Ben's peeing right now, so. Okay, bye-bye.
I am shocked to learn that Ben has a 2-hour and 10-minute bladder. I mean, what's that about? You wouldn't be able to sit through the next Star Trek film.
Oh, and by the way, all right. Ben, if you are gone for sure, you'll be hearing this later when you maybe listen to this episode. I have not hit stop yet. So this is going to be a thrill for him to hear. All right, bye-bye.
Fantastic episode. See ya. See ya.